UK Wine Show, show number 201. Michael Herrick, New Zealand Pinot Noir. G'day and welcome to the UK Wine Show. My name's Chris Scott, and this week the UK Wine Show is talking with Michael Herrick. Michael is the marketing director at Mount Difficulty Wines in Central Otago, and we're going to be talking to him about Pinots from Central Otago, but also Pinots from all over New Zealand. It's been a busy week for me. I was judging at the International Wine Challenge for a couple of days, as well as a few tastings, so I only spent about 1 or 2 days in the office this week. Next week is another busy week with the big English trade tasting on the 3rd of May, and given that the London International Wine Fair is coming up at the end of May, it's going to be a busy time for tasting wines and recording shows. As I said earlier, we've got Michael Herrick on this week talking about New Zealand Pinot Noir, but I actually bought some New Zealand Pinots this week. Not a surprise you say, but I bought a couple of cases of various wines at Sainsbury's this week. Now, I don't normally buy a lot of wines at the supermarkets. I prefer to buy them from other places, but Sainsbury's have a 25% offer on at the moment on any 6 wines you buy. It's probably one of the best promotions that I'm really interested in. Sainsbury's and some of the other supermarkets normally do this at Christmas time to encourage people to stock up large in November for Christmas, realize you're all going to drink the wine before Christmas and then have to restock up again. So it's a cunning way of them getting a few sales. But it's the first time I've seen them doing this in April. Now, normally I'm not too bothered about supermarket offers. You know, I don't care if a wine's half off because I simply don't trust the supermarket pricing. I think if you're going to stock up on these wines at 25% off, I think it's a good opportunity, but buy wines that you really are interested in and not the ones that are typically on special. Anyway, from moaning about the supermarket's offers, although I'm not really moaning, I'm giving a big old plug, I suppose, to this week's mystery, a wine region. As usual, I'm going to give you a clue now, clue before the interview, and then the answer at the end of the show. See if you can work out what mystery wine region we're talking about. Now, our mystery wine region is a new wine region in Chile, located around 600 kilometres north of Santiago and traditionally known for table grape and for the distilled spirit, Pisco. That's a brandy style of wine. The wine region was started producing exciting table wines in the mid-1990s. In the Limeri Valley, one of its 3 sub-regions, the others being Alqui and the other being Choapa Valley. The cooling Pacific Ocean is the key here in delaying ripening, while the drier weather, annual rainfall is only 100 millimetres, and clear skies allow healthy fruit growing conditions. If we think about this mystery region that is made up of Limeri, Alqui, and Choapa Valleys. Because next up we have the news with Jane.
Thanks, Chris. The Academy of Food and Wine Service has joined forces with the London International Wine Fair in a move which will see the exhibition play host to the finals of the annual UK Sommelier of the Year competition for the first time. The competition, which is in its 33rd year, requires entrants to test their product knowledge as well as demonstrate their ability to serve wine correctly. This will be put to the test in a mock-up restaurant scenario at the wine fair. The move puts the competition in the heart of what is one of the most important dates in the wine trade calendar. The event is set to attract many top sommeliers from around the country, and the finals of the competition will take place in the waterfront rooms on Wednesday the 23rd of May, with places available by invitation only.
As I mentioned earlier at the beginning of the show, not long to go, about 4 weeks to the London International Wine Fair. If you're in the trade and you're listening, you should be attending. If you're not in the trade, well, sorry, it is a trade event. What is exciting about this event is the range of wines available and the information one can learn. If you live outside London, London International Wine Fair are putting a bursary on for those in the trade. If you need to, say, get cover for your store while you're out or help for the transportation. I think the bursary is worth about £50 and it was definitely worth applying for. I have a couple of interviews with London International Wine Fair organisers, Brintex, and we'll be releasing them shortly before the fair. What's the next story, Jane?
Well, a gene fusion research project could help fight Pierce's disease in California. The grapevine disease was first noted in California around 1884 and is now known to exist in 28 Californian counties. From 1994 to 2000, the disease destroyed more than 1,000 acres of Northern California grapevines, causing $30 million of damages. In grapevines, Xylella fastidiosa is carried from plant to plant by half-inch long insects known as sharpshooters. The bacteria infect and clog the plant's water-transporting tissue. and grapevines with Pierce's disease develop yellow and brown leaves and die within a few years. There's currently no known cure for Pierce's disease, but researchers at UC Davis have tested the hypothesis that disease-causing microbes can evade one defensive action by a host plant, but believe that most microbes would have difficulty overcoming a combination of two immune system defences. To block such infections, the researchers engineered a hybrid gene by fusing together two genes that are responsible for two key functions of the plant's innate immune response. That is, recognising Zeisella fastidiosa, the bacteria responsible for Pierce's disease, as a bacterial invader and destroying its outer membranes, causing the bacteria to die. The researchers then inserted this hybrid gene into the grapevines. They found that sap from plants genetically engineered with the hybrid gene effectively killed Zeisella fastidiosa in the laboratory. And grapevines engineered to carry the hybrid gene has significantly less leaf scorching and xylem clogging, indicating resistance to Pierce's disease.
While Pierce's disease cannot at present overcome the genetic manipulation, highly likely that once out in the field, it will be able to adapt. It is one thing to create a new hybrid species, but once you start down this road, you are still in an arms race with nature. You are just using new tools. But once you start, it is the thin edge of a wedge and will result in increasing escalation. I'm not saying that it's wrong, I'm just saying it's not a closed process, just the beginning of an accelerating process. One advantage vines have over many annual crops is that almost all vines are created using clones, and as such there's very little risk of cross-contamination or genes escaping into the wild. A risk that such plants as wheat and maize, genetically modified organisms, cannot ensure. So there's less risk of GMOs escaping for vines than, say, wheat, which is a good thing. What's the last story, Jane?
Well, a new study is out that shows potentially wine experts taste differently to non-wine experts. 330 participants in America were divided into two groups of wine experts and consumers and given a taste test. The idea was to establish if wine expertise is learned or genetic. The group were given a paper disc treated with some drops of the chemical prop and asked to take it and asked to taste it. Prop sensitivity is an expression of the TAS2R38 gene, and about 25% of us find prop bitter. This reduces to 10% in men. Some find prop tasteless and others find it mildly or extremely bitter. Based on the reactions to the prop, participants were labelled non-tasters, medium tasters or super tasters if they found it extremely bitter. The study found that wine experts experience higher bitterness than non-experts. Professor John Hayes and Gary Pickering concluded that differences in prop sensitivities between the two groups may suggest a possible discordance in judgments of quality and value, and that wine experts have a genetically different sense of taste than the consumers they serve. So, if wine professionals are super tasters, does that mean their wine recommendations are mismatched with consumers' tastes? Other scientists advise caution, feeling that the study could be overstated, and another professional commented that the study indicated that some experts are potential super tasters of prop and nothing more. He believes that with a mouth and a tongue, you can work hard on both aroma recognition and taste, and you can become a good taster. That's it from me this week, but do check out these stories at our website 3050.co.uk.
Cheers, Jane. It's an interesting idea that wine experts are different to the public. It is also true that wine experts are part self-selecting. That is, if you're quite sensitive, you're more likely to join the wine trade, I think. It also makes me wonder about wine awards such as the International Wine Challenge, International Wine Spirit Competition, and Decanter, all who use experts to judge the wine. As well as that, it also raises a discussion I had at the judging of the International Wine Challenge this week. We were tasting two Alsace Rieslings, and neither of them are what I would call a typical Alsace Riesling. One was very limey, lime-like, like an Aussie Riesling, with a huge backbone of acidity. The other was much softer and more floral, a bit like a Pfalz Riesling, but with great complexity. Now, I know from my time tasting with the public and looking at the results, because we get people in the public to rate the results when we do our wine tastings at people's houses, that the Pfalz Riesling will be much, much preferred to a real limey, quite tart Riesling. It's the sort of wine you might enjoy half a glass of, but you really don't want to drink a whole bottle. As most of the judges on my panel are not normal, they gave the wine I think most people wouldn't like a higher medal than the one that most people would like. So not only are the judges who are putting the judging together self-selecting and taste differently to normal population, the judges will rate wines that I don't think the general public like. And the reason for that is just because their palates, over tasting so many wines, you start looking for quite strange qualities in a wine. And the Limey Alsace Riesling was quite a nice wine, don't get me wrong. I just don't think most people would like it. It made me think about a business study I heard this week about how to promote people successfully in organizations. A group of mathematicians had shown that businesses will perform better if promotions were random rather than based on merit. The argument goes that you get promoted because you get along with your boss and hence encourage groupthink and a lack of new insights. The second being that people get promoted to their point of incompetence. So people have been in the job for a while may not be as competent in that job than some random person given the role. And it makes me wonder about the Consumer Lodi Wine Awards being organized or helped organize by Tim Hannay, where the public are measured on their taste sensitivity, sensitive or super taster to normal or non-taster. Then the general public, who are then the judges, get to judge the wines for your similar sensitivity. So if you're a sensitive taster, you judge the wine and your recommendations are based on that for other sensitive tasters. For those who are non-tasters, you get to judge wines and represent non-tasters so that the genetic bias in people gets to come through. Now, this level of resolution has a lot going for it, with results that could be a lot more meaningful than other competitions judged by wine experts. That's me as well, don't get me wrong. I'm just thinking that perhaps some of these competitions aren't quite as useful as a lot of people think. Anyway, that finishes the news. I'm going to give you the second clue in our mystery wine region now. And as I said earlier, this Chilean wine region has around 2,310 hectares of vineyards now planted. The majority in Limerick, an area which is both old and new as winemaking is concerned. Vines were first planted here in the mid-16th century, but new technology has meant terroir-hunting winemakers have taken a new approach, and now wines in Limerick are trademarked by freshness and distinct minerality. Chardonnay does particularly well. Alki Valley, at the southern edge of the Atacama Desert, has grapes growing all the way from the coast to the high into the Andes, up to 2,000 metres above sea level. This region is specially known for its cool climate Syrah and is Chile's key region for Pisco Brandy. Now, this isn't really important for the mystery grape variety, but Pisco Brandy is a double distilled wine in a copper pot, a bit like whiskey, but made from Muscatay, Torrontés and sometimes Pedro Ximénez grapes. As I say, it's a brandy. I haven't actually tried it yet, but I will be trying it hopefully sometime soon. Choapa is a small valley located at Chile's narrowest point, where there is no distinction between the Andes and the coastal mountains. There are no wineries here as yet, but vineyards planted on rocky pediment soils produce small quantities of high-quality Syrah and Cabernet Sauvignon. Have we think about that? Next up, we've got the interview, which is coming up next with Michael Herrick. Let's have a listen to what Michael has to say about Pinot Noir from New Zealand. Hi, my name's Chris Scott and I'm here with Michael Herrick from Mount Difficulty. How are you, Michael?
Good, thanks, Chris.
Excellent. Today we're going to talk a wee bit about some of the grape varieties in Central Otago and a bit more focus on Central Otago. So how does Pinot vary from different parts of New Zealand, you know, Central, Marlborough, Martinborough? Well, do they actually make any Pinot Noir up in Hawke's Bay?
Oh, certainly. There is some quite large plantings of Pinot, actually, particularly in the higher country. On the plateaus, the cooler areas, there is some Pinot there. But as you say, probably a lot of it's for sparkling base.
Yeah. So how do you see the difference, say, between Martinborough, Marlborough, Whiteborough and Otago?
You know, I think the beauty or the joy of Pinot, and it's what people fall in love with, is its ability to reflect the region and even down to the specific site that it's grown in. So yes, there is, you can definitely see a large range and style, and this is pretty broad brush stuff, but generally speaking, for me, the wines of Martinborough, that region was the first planted in New Zealand and showed, and still shows, enormous promise for high-end Pinot, but it tends to give a very what I call savoury type character to the Pinot Noir, even from release, which we don't see down in central Otago till much later on in bottle age development.
Mm-hmm.
For me, moving down to Marlborough, I see a lot more red fruit characters and some quite pretty wines and much more fruit forward in nature. And as we move further south, it's getting cooler and we're getting to see some real structure coming through and showing in the wines. There's some really exciting examples coming out of North Canterbury and the likes of Ben Hill and Pegasus Bay and all around that area.
Mm.
And they're growing in some limestone and they're starting to reflect minerality as well, and I would say regionality. And then, of course, moving right down to central Otago, much cooler again. We have this definitely the highest diurnal temperature variance, which I think gives very classic central Otago bright vibrancy to the wine. They are very expressive. They have a really lovely natural acidity to them, as well as the structure.
And high alcohols as well.
In warmer years, they can be.
Not out of balance. I'm not saying they're not, but, you know, it's pretty rare to get high acidity and high alcohol. Well, Pinot can do that, but, you know, to get those big alcohols and the acidity and the fruit there as well, it's quite a nice... It balances all right. I do worry about Otago Pinot's aging, though. You know, have you tried anything really old under screw cap? Because the last bottle I had that I thought aged really, really well from Otago was a 2000 Ripon, and that was under a cork. And I drank my last bottle of that probably about 3 years ago, and it was... Every year I thought it was going to fall a bit, it's going to fall a bit, it's going to drink it faster, it's going to fall a bit, it's going to fall... Never did. And it just got more and more interesting as it got older. And then I ran out of bottles to watch it go any longer. But I've got Pinots that I've kept for 5-6 years, and they're not really showing any progression. You just lose the fruit over time and no real development. Have you guys seen wines develop nicely?
Yeah, well, we've been running trials with screw cap for at least 10 years now. And we've also encouraged some of our peers to do the same. And just recently, we had a vertical tasting of last 10 years under screw cap with the winemakers to compare like-to-like cork from screw cap over the last 10 years. It was all done completely blind, and it was an interesting result. It wasn't what they expected. Unanimously, screw cap was the preferred seal, the preferred wine under that seal, under blind tasting conditions. And I think what they expected to see was more evolution of the wines under cork with a little bit more savouriness and possibly less fruit. But in fact, I think what they saw was better balance of fruit to structure coming through in the screw caps, because there was still actually fruit showing through much more vibrantly in the screw cap than there was under the cork in the same wine.
I think if you did it over here, you'd probably get a different answer there, because New Zealand producers and that like, and New Zealanders like fruity wines, whereas over here there's a... I've been showing this wine to some people, Vinnobre di Montepulciano, and it's only about 6 years old, but my God, there's no fruit in the wine left, and people go, they either love it desperately or they hate it. Mm. Now, I'm not a big fan of the wine myself, but I know a load of people love it, and there ain't no fruit in that, so I think you might find that in some places, in some of your markets, different people actually appreciate different qualities than maybe in New Zealand. I'd be really interested if you ever did a vertical here. That would be quite an interesting thing to see.
Absolutely, and I'd agree. It's a very personal thing, cellaring wine, and the UK have traditionally enjoyed wine with less fruit and much more about the bottle age character, and you'll see probably some of the greatest collectors of old wines in the world based here in the UK for that reason. And I guess that's changing to some extent. People are wanting to see at least a little life and fruit in the wine with some time and age. You asked earlier how we see the wines evolve. The wines that we taste going back 10 years, they certainly age very elegantly, and they tend to evolve from the primary fruits, those dark brooding cherries and so on, dark fruits that we see in their youth. And as they go on to age, they get much more forest floor and a little bit of earthy...
Oh, you do get some of those
mushroom characters, and that all starts kicking in.
What age?
Well, we recommend our estate Pinot. It'll probably be at its peak, depending on the vintage, evolving all that mushroom and earthiness from 7 to 10 years of age. Mm, okay. It'd be at its best,
yep.
And possibly longer, but depends on the vintage.
Okay, I'll have a look at that. I don't know if I've gone quite that far. I think I've got up to about 5 years, and I haven't really seen anything but the fruit back off. So
pulled out an O2 in my cellar recently, and it's looking just fantastic. There's still plenty of life, but it's got the earth, it's got the forest floor and mushroom coming through, which that's the excitement for Pinot.
So I always get almost a wee bit disappointed with some Pinots from New Zealand, because they always, to me, seem quite linear. You know, they don't really show that development. Maybe I'm just not giving them enough time. I'm an impatient person at the best of times when it comes to wine.
I think you're much like the rest of us. And I saw an interesting article the other day in America that said the average cellaring time for wine now is about 28 minutes from point of purchase, which,
yeah, I believe that, yeah,
pretty much sums it up.
Yeah, now I've got some, I do keep some wines for a reasonable length, but I have to see what I've got in my cases. Okay, let's just touch on a wee bit of some of the stuff that's going on in Central Otago. You were saying earlier that you guys have purchased an estate, or not purchased, but you've accessed some grapes from Lowburn, which is a wine region in Central. I don't really think of Lowburn as a wine producing region. First of all, where is Lowburn relative to, say, Bannockburn? Because I think most people who know a wee bit about Central Otago know what it's good at. They've probably heard of Gibson Valley. They've probably heard of Bannockburn. Other sub-regions, no, and Lowburn almost certainly not. So where is Lowburn and what are you doing there?
Right, well, I think this is the evolution and the excitement long-term for Central Otago. It's a natural progression. For me, I think Central Otago has the ability to be the Burgundy of the Southern Hemisphere. We've got many little sub-regions and site-specific vineyards that can offer some serious points of difference and their own unique nature. So I think that's the evolution of the region for me, and a lot of that comes from the grape or the vine age. After a certain time, the grapes or the vines have the ability to reflect the region they're planted in, and that's what we're looking for now. Lowburn is a sub-region within the greater Central Otago area, which is slightly north of Bannockburn, northwest, just under the base of the Pisa Range.
So I think the way I think about it is, if you're in Cromwell and you're heading up to Wanaka, it's on the left-hand side on the way up?
Precisely, yes. Yeah, so on heading north on the Wanaka Road, left-hand side, you drive in through a little valley into a nice little microclimate in a basin, north-facing basin. It's a little bit higher up in altitude. It's roughly 350 metres above sea level. And it's slightly cooler and later ripening. So we get quite elegant, quite perfumed, and quite pretty fruit. And I think quite different to what we're seeing in Bannockburn along Felton Road there, where we're getting very robust, masculine style, all these brooding dark fruits versus much more perfume and elegant, pretty style that you see in Lowburn.
Okay.
And what Mount Difficulty are trying to achieve is really showcase and celebrate the differences in each of these sub-regions. And there are at least a good half a dozen sub-regions within Central Otago that are all quite uniquely different for various reasons. And long-term, I would love to see small parcels of wines reflective of each of those regions to showcase the area.
Do you think it will get there? Central Otago is fairly niche anyway at the moment for wine consumers. I think Bannockburn's got some visibility now. You know, you've got Fountain Road, you've got your guys, there's quite a few good producers down that area. It's not a big one, but the producers that are there are all, you know, they seem to produce the best wines. Well, perceived, my view anyway.
Very generous. Thank you.
But I'm a bit concerned that maybe some of these other regions might just become too much detail. You know, you start getting into the Italian situation where, you know,
or the Burgundy situation.
Yeah, exactly, which is just too complicated for for enough visibility to drive your marketing.
Yeah, I mean, that there is that point, and it's a very valid one. It becomes quite fragmented. So the story gets a little watered down. However, for Pinot lovers like myself, people are looking for a point of difference. They're celebrating the point of difference. They're always trying to explore why and understand how it's affected the wines. And I think that's the exciting part about Pinot Noir, and I think that's the exciting things that Central Otago have to offer. And that, for me, will come only with Vine Age, and possibly in the next 20 years, you'll see the quantum leap in quality and expression of those sites.
We mentioned earlier about the different sort of tiers in Central Otago. Just before we started this interview, you were talking about how you're starting to expand your winery. What's going on there?
Well, there's a few things at play there. I mean, we mentioned earlier there's the site-specific differences, and there's the sub-regional differences. But even beyond that, there's which are mostly climate-driven, there's also massive soil differences depending on where you go. Mount Difficulty have three levels which are all about trying to reflect those points of difference. We firstly have a wine that is all about the regional reflection of the region, and that's the Roaring Meg range. And the main differences there is the vineyards are situated in the valley floor of the Cromwell Basin. Mm-hmm. Now that's further north up the valley from Bannockburn. The soil's quite different. It's a lot of ground-up schist, alluvial silts. It's an old glacier bed. And the nature of the wines are very reflective of that soil. They're lighter and more fruit-driven, and they're quite aromatic and pretty. They tend to develop, or our vineyards tend to develop wines that are drinking well earlier. So they're probably at their peak within 3 to 4 years. And they're much more about, I guess, instant gratification and enjoyment. Whereas we see, as you move south for us into Bannockburn, the temperatures rise, there's more warmth, the soils also pick up a greater amount of clay, and you just have more depth and structure in the wines. And it gives us the ability to produce wines that have ageability and also massive complexities. That we just didn't see in some of our vineyards in the valley floor.
One of the things about Central Otago that I've seen is that, you know, the Pinot Noir is king, but I have seen a lot of different white wines here. You know, I've been to your place and tried some Pinot Gris, and I've even tried aromatic Sauvignon Blancs from Central Otago, though I didn't really rate that. What are you guys doing with your whites?
Over the last 5 years, we've something that Mount Difficulty's really looked at, actually, is developing the white wine market and addressing the natural balance of things, as 85% of the region's planted in red wine, but nearly half of the market wants to drink white. So we've planted 5 years ago now in the valley floor, a little bit further north of Bannockburn, on the Cromwell Basin, 40 hectares of just white wine. So we're looking at aromatic whites that we think and believe are very well suited to the climate and the soils. And given that the area itself reminds me a lot of the Alsace in its climate and soil types, the schist, and parts of Germany, we chose to plant Riesling, Pinot Gris, a little bit of Gewürztraminer, and also some Sauvignon Blanc. Which is a great point of difference, I think, from what you've seen out of the Sauvignons that are further north. They tip their cap in the direction of, say, Sancerre, where they're more leaner, more minerally, and more flinty.
Yeah, they're certainly not as aromatic as the Marlborough.
Absolutely, no, they're not. You can't put them in the same style as that pungent Marlborough style. They're much, much more towards the European counterparts.
And are they still quite expensive? You know, are you paying quite a bit for it because your yields are down, or?
Oh, I think they're on par with some of the Marlborough, the more premium Marlborough-style Sauvignon Blancs. We sell one over here, and it's mostly targeted for on-premise, the restaurant trade, and it would retail around £25. And we have another one, which is in the Roaring Meg range, and that would retail around £13 to £14. So certainly not outrageously expensive.
All right then, Michael, I think we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Hope you enjoyed that interview with Michael. That ends the last interview I had with Michael. I popped in and did a couple of interviews with him a couple of weeks ago, and thought they were quite interesting, particularly about the New Zealand update last week. As said, we've got some London International Wine Fair interviews coming up in the next wee while before the big show, and also, don't forget, the English Trade Tasting is coming up very shortly. But the answer to our mystery wine region is Coquimbo. Now, Coquimbo is the large area that Auckland, Limerick and Choapa valleys are part of. And it's located around 600 kilometres north of the Chilean capital, Santiago, and first started producing exciting wines in the mid-1990s. The cool Pacific Ocean is key here in delaying the ripening, while the dry weather, with its annual rainfall of only 100 millimetres, and the clear skies allow healthy grape-growing conditions. The region is especially known for its cool climate, Serra, but high-quality Cabernet Sauvignon can also be grown in small quantities. And to finish up with this week is a quote, and this week it's from Hugh Johnson. It's not really a quote, it's more of a paragraph, but I think it's an interesting paragraph, and here we go. The scope of the subject of wine is never-ending, as indeed so many other subjects lie within its boundaries. Without geography and topology, it's incomprehensible. Without history, it's colourless. Without taste, it is meaningless. Without travel, it remains unreal. It embraces botany, chemistry, agriculture, carpentry, economics, any number of sciences whose names I do not even know. It leads you up paths of knowledge and byways of experiences you would never glimpse without it. I quite like that. That relates to the way I look at wine as well. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.